City Council meeting on June 25th, 2012. We are happy to have everyone here. Appreciate you being here with us. And as usual, as we go through our meeting, if you want to talk about any of the subjects on the agenda, you're welcome to do that. And we try to keep your conversations to about 5 minutes. We would appreciate it. And without further ado here, we'll start our meeting and have our council pledge and pledge allegiance to the council prayer, excuse me, and our pledge of allegiance.
Let us pray. Almighty and merciful Lord, as we gather this evening, we are surrounded by a world riddled by conflict. Deliver to us peace. We are challenged by issues of the moment. Deliver to us the best vision for our future. Daily distractions threaten to keep us from achievement. Deliver to us patience. We can be quick to judge and slow to understand. Deliver to us learning. We all can be overwhelmed by the sheer volume of issues our community faces. Deliver to us persistence. Amen.
Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
First item of business is the minutes. Consideration of the June 11th, 2012 regular meeting minutes and the executive session of June 18th, 2012. Is there any discussion necessary on the minutes?
Yes, two quick comments. One of the agenda items last time was how a council person could get on the agenda, and I guess I'm going to have to look for a third way. I got turned down on one item, which was rather controversial. So does this need to be on the agenda again, or I can communicate with the city attorney and city manager later? However we need to handle that, I don't want to bog us down here. Then the other thing, there's some information that some of the people have requested on the subject about Chucker Creek. And I think the bond was discussed there, and I don't know that we talked about the bond covering landscaping, and I don't think it does that.
It actually covers the easement, Mr. Ebner. We had Mr. Morris take a look at that. It does cover mainly infrastructure, but it covers the easement and the preparation of the easement according to the concept plan. So we feel that we have some funds there. We've been in contact with the developer, and of course, any plantings that are put in now, we've lost some pine trees, and I actually had an opportunity Friday afternoon to tour this area of the ridge at Chucker Creek from the Woodside side of the fence, and I understand much more clearly what the Millers were describing at our last regular meeting in this room. And the developer is prepared to replace the dead landscaping, and obviously the concept plan calls for landscaping at the borders because that was removed. I think you and I talked this afternoon about a hillside at the top end, and then below the detention area, there's just weeds growing there. There really isn't any plant installation there. And we anticipate by the end of October that work would begin so that the plant can winter over and hopefully have a better survival rate than what we've seen.
So the clarification I was asking, the bond does cover
the easement.
Which
is that what we're talking about, that buffer area, right?
Okay.
And again, I did give a copy of the memo, and I have a copy for council as well. I think I already gave a copy to you, Mr. Edmund. I gave a copy to the Millers to take with them, and we're going to provide a link so that, you know, folks can just go online instead of having to handle a bunch of paperwork. They can just find the section that they particularly want to look at. Before council leaves tonight, I've got that follow-up memo on the ridge at Chucker.
I know we're talking about the minutes, and I don't want to get into anything beyond that, but it was my understanding, Richard, that this item is going to be on the agenda at our next meeting. Is that still your plan?
It can be. My understanding is the main issue was the planning along the border between the ridge at Chucker Creek and Woodside, and we've got a plan forward with that. If we need to have a discussion with the developer, we were just trying to verify whether the developer was going to be in town on July 9, and I've not heard anything. Mr. Evans has not heard anything either, so we're trying to verify.
My concern, as I've mentioned to you personally, was with a bond and what the bond provides coverage
right.
for.
Right.
I don't know that the developer needs to be here, but
right.
the council seems overly sensitive to his concerns, so I guess if we want to wait until he can be here, that's fine, but I would like this on the agenda as soon as we can get it there, so that I can have a clear understanding of what that bond is, because it sounds like it's not...
Well, now, Mr. Morris is here. He can speak to the scope of the bond, because he's looked at that. We've discussed it.
Again, we're,
yeah, I understand.
We're getting away from what Gary's going to talk to us about, so I just would leave it with you, and I'd like to see that discussed at a council meeting.
Okay. Well,
okay, you're asking for it to be on the agenda next meeting?
Yes.
Okay.
And the other thing is I'm confused with Councilman Ebner's comment that you wanted something on and it wasn't?
Well,
it was this item, and the item was to change the concept plan, and what the city attorney had said is that council had not changed any concept plans on its own motion. You know, that's what we brought the developer in, I guess, like a year ago, and the developer was very clear that he did not want to change the concept plan. So that's why we were going to have the follow-up conversation with him. I think he may be misunderstanding what we're looking for. And my understanding is what we're looking for is that buffer area between the two subdivisions, more so than an equestrian trail.
That's correct, and not to clear any more of the buffer zone.
Right, exactly. And we strongly believe that's something that the developer is going to be very amenable to, since the stormwater erosion is what keyed the riprap installation in the subdivision. That was something that Mr. Evans and Mr. Morris and Mr. LeDuc discussed years ago.
I think Mr. DeWar's item for the agenda should be on there. Then it's on the agenda. We discuss the bond and be done with it.
Yeah, just make sure Richard knows everything you want to discuss.
And I'm not interested in changing the concept plan. Please understand that clearly.
You asked what Mr. Ebner asked for.
I've said on a couple of occasions, and nobody's cleared my concern is that I think there's a disconnect between what the council-approved concept plan is and what the staff seems to think is going to happen out there. And I think there's a disconnect, and that's the only issue that...
There were some administrative amendments to the concept plan that is correct.
Yeah, and they seem to be...
Could we be clear? Could we have all those administrative amendments so that we have the whole picture next meeting?
That's what
I'd
like to get.
We're talking about this issue now, and we...
I've got it on the list.
It's not on the agenda.
Yeah, I've got it. So I've got it on the list for next time.
We're talking about it with the connection to the minutes, so just want to make sure we understood what the minutes are.
Okay. I've got it on the list for next time.
Is there anything else on the minutes?
I move approval.
Okay. Do we have a second? We have a second. All in favor, show of hands, please. Passes unanimously. And the presentations, the first one is an award presentation, GFOA Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting. Mr. Pierce, please.
Council has my memo. Mayor Dennis Locke is here. He came all the way down from the city of Spartanburg. We're welcome to Aiken. We're so glad to have you with us, and it's a very happy occasion. He was sharing with us Spartanburg's success in their accounting efforts, but he's here to present for the 20th time our Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting. And it is 20 consecutive years that the city of Aiken has received that. That's no small feat, and a lot of credit goes to our finance director, Kim Abney, and her staff, who put in a lot of hours, work with our auditor. We just get countless questions about our financial operations, so it's a real feather in our cap to receive this again. And Dennis, I don't want to steal any of your thunder. Please come up to the microphone and tell us all about it.
Well, Mayor and Council, I think as Mr. Pierce has already clearly outlined, this award is given each year to municipalities who meet very rigorous guidelines for a financial statement, and it is an honor for the city of Aiken to have this 20 years in a row. Just because you get it 1 year doesn't mean it guarantees it for the next year. You have to continue to meet the guidelines of the standards that are made by the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. And as Kim knows, those standards can change quite drastically. Even I noticed on your agenda tonight, you're going over GASB 45 and those type of changes. So each year, it seems like here recently, there's always been different changes that cities have to incorporate into their financial statements. So it is with great honor that we do, from the state GFOA and also the national GFOA, present this award to Mayor and Council for 20 consecutive years of getting a Certificate of Excellence Award.
Kim, thank you. Would you come here, Kim? Are you going to say? Would you say something? Do you want to say something? I'm going to give this to you.
I can understand. I appreciate Dennis coming down from Spartanburg. He is the state representative for the Government Finance Officers Association, but he is also the finance director at the city of Spartanburg. So I know he's had a busy day today, and I appreciate him coming down and being with us tonight on this celebration. So thank you.
Well, Kim, thank you and your staff for the excellent job you do. And have been doing for a long time. Yes, sir.
I can understand why they need to move to Lawrence Street. They're running out of wall space for all the
That's a lot. We literally are.
Dennis, thank you for driving down.
So good to see you. Thank you, sir.
Good job. You go already. Item two has to do with the retirement plan and other post-retirement health benefits, retiree health insurance. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you so much. There's really not an item for council vote tonight. This is more for receipt of information. Warner Anthony is here, and council recall he was with us about a year ago, and a little over a year ago, actually, and talked with us about employee benefits, but specifically our pension plan. And we also mentioned other post-employment benefits, OPEB. And retirees under our existing plan are entitled to health insurance benefits until age 65. And the council has expressed throughout our budget process concerns about the pension plan. We certainly had an extensive discussion in this room about employee benefits, but then also these OPEB payments. And quite rightfully so, when you look at the national media, you pick up the Wall Street Journal, other publications, you certainly see comments about local, county, state, even federal governments that have retirement benefits and unfunded future liabilities. We certainly, with the end of the legislative session without a budget, I note the state has wrestled with not just their pension plan and the Terry plan and the double dipping that has occurred with that, but anticipated shortfalls with the state retirement fund of somewhere between $15-16 billion, which is a tremendous future responsibility. And while the legislature feels that they have dealt with their immediate needs for funding the pension plan, they did not address other post-employment benefits. Several years ago, and even before it was legally required, the city of Aiken began making contributions to a trust fund, and the funds once paid in have to be used to pay for these health insurance benefits. They can't be used for any other purpose. So with the establishment of that trust fund, certainly through our audit process, the budget process, we've had several questions about whether we have this looming unfunded future indebtedness and liability to employees who retire and qualify for the benefit. Warner Anthony, as you'll recall, is our plan attorney. He does a great job reviewing the applicable federal laws and the applicable government accounting standards board regulations that we find ourselves wrestling with. Gosh, Warner, it seems like we talk quite often these days. And and particularly since GASB, Government Accounting Standards Board, has released two standards today, and they will affect how your audit is prepared, the numbers you will see in that audit, and what we are required to show you. That's on one hand. On another hand, we're looking at funding, and initially when GASB 45 was talked about, it was very unclear how much local government should be putting in the trust fund for these future benefits. And many governments put in $0. They said, well, we'll just worry about that later. We'll figure it out and come up with the money somehow. And the staff here at the City of Aiken did not do that. The council worked with us and did approve contributions to the OPEB account, the trust fund. And as a result, we do have funds on hand, and we are working to make sure that we have devoted the proper amount of money for this anticipated future expense. In doing so, and with the questions that council had, of course, we wanted to bring Warner back to talk with you about OPEB and answer your questions, but also give you a presentation of some approaches we believe will make the amount of money that we are contributing to that special trust account, which is separate from the pension plan. This is actually just for the post-employment benefit trust that we think will be very helpful and will help us with the actuarial numbers on the amount of money that we should be contributing. Based on Warner's presentation tonight and council's feeling about the presentation, we will proceed to enter into a conversation with our actuaries. You have approved a contribution amount in the budget under the general fund. It was $150,000, and in the utilities fund it was $50,000. It's about $200,000, which is in line with contributions we've made in the past. That's reduced somewhat from last year. But the reason we reduced it is we believe that some of the actuarial assumptions are easily modified and we believe will result in a savings to the taxpayer and a responsible deposit into the trust fund for this future responsibility. So without any further ado, Warner, if you could let us know. You have Warner's memo that's attached to the memo that I provide you. It's dated June 14th, and then we also went ahead and provided you with the review of benefits that Warner discussed in part when we had our full session on the discussion on employee benefits. Warner, you've come all the way down from Greensboro, North Carolina. We're glad to have you back with us.
Thank you, Mayor and members of the council. I'd like to review for everyone the retiree health benefit program, what we did from the beginning. I recognize some of the faces who were here in 2006 when we first looked at it, but some of you were not here. So I'd like to kind of bring everyone together as to what we've done as we've gone along and what we're proposing to do this year. Then I would like to discuss some retirement plan issues, some open issues, make some clarifications, and give you some more data on the retirement plan. And I'll tell you when I finish the retiree health issue, so you have any questions, we can take those at that time. Then I'll go to the retirement plan. But let me tell you that in 2004, GASB, which is the Government Accounting Standards Board, released GASB 45 that said that public employers for the first time would have to start accounting for retiree health benefits. Prior to that time, Aiken was working on a pay-as-you-go system. They just paid for the retiree medical benefits each year, expensed it that year, no liability, there was no accounting, and it was a relatively minor amount, a few number of retirees, and it wasn't a big number. But when this came out in 2004, we realized that it had a phase-in. It did not become effective to Aiken till 2009. However, at that point, we said, the city management said, the council said, let's look at what this impact is going to be. Something's going to start hitting our financial statements. Let's have an idea ahead of time of what it's going to be. So in 2006, there was an actuarial study prepared under GASB 45 showing you what would happen, you know, under the existing plan if no changes were made. And at that point, upon seeing the liability, seeing the expense, seeing the growth of that, it was determined that the city could not continue its program unchanged, that those numbers were just too big to be in your financial statements. So it was decided at that time to use a July 1, 2006 cutoff date, that anyone hired before July 1, 2006 would remain under the existing retiree health plan. For those who were hired after July 1, 2006, if they retired prior to age 65, while they could purchase retiree health benefits for retirement before age 65, they would be required to pay 100% of the cost of those benefits, including any what's called implied subsidy. So by requiring them to pay the 100% of the cost, there would be no GASB liability. So basically, the city froze its GASB liability with respect to its employees. No new employees would cause the occurrence of any GASB liability. Now, the impact of that, to give you some idea, on June 30, 2006, there were 317 full-time city employees who would have been eligible, who were eligible to grow into retiree health benefits. So your universe was 317 people. We froze that at 317 people. With turnover and such, as of June 19 of this year, there are still 322 full-time employees. But of those 322, only 188 of those people were hired before July 1, 2006. So only 188 of those people are eligible for retiree health benefits. You have therefore, through this one change alone, already reduced the potential group of eligible people by over 45%. So that in itself has had a big impact. That was the first big item, and with that freeze, you're saying the group we're dealing with for the retiree health benefits are those who were hired before July 1, 2006. Anyone hired after that date, there's no GASB liability, they have to pay. Now, for once people retire at and reach 65, you still, regardless of when they were hired, you still provide a Medicare supplement benefit available to them that they pay for, that they pay a portion of based on having to have a certain amount of service. But that Medicare supplement benefit is a very, very minor cost in the overall scheme of things on that. So what happens? We did that one big change. Then what happens? Every year, the committee reviews the actuarial report. It looks at what's being done. It looks for ways to tweak this a little bit. And so what happened, one of the things the city said was that you have multiple health plans based that your employees can join based on their date of hire. And under the rules that were in existence, when you take early retirement, you continue the health plan that you are eligible to continue the health plan you were in. And when you got to be 65, you could continue a health plan. But the city said, no, starting at age 65, we're going to move everyone to a Medicare supplement plan. So that also reduces cost. To give you an idea, the Med 100 plan has a per capita cost of over $12,000 per person, per capita, $12,000. The Medicare supplement has a cost of under right at $5,000. You can see if you move people from the Med 100 to the Medicare supplement, you have a huge savings. So by doing that, you're going to have a further that, and that became fully effective this July 1. People were encouraged to move to the Medicare supplement, and those who were not moved were all moved on July 1. So that will also have an impact on lowering the cost. We're also, at the time, we intended that people hired after July 1, 2006, we intended that they would pay 100% of their cost for their medical coverage if they took early retirement. And that by counting 100% of their cost, that included any what's called implied subsidy cost based on an age bracket. Right now, within the city, an employee age 25 pays the same cost as an employee age 55 for medical coverage. Under GASB 45, we have to age bracket, and those older people actually have a higher cost. And we discovered that the actuary was counting in the implied subsidy in the calculation of cost. So we're changing the plan to make it clear that the cost, by paying their full cost, it includes the implied subsidy. That's a little change, but it's a little change to lower your liability. Finally, the big item that we think of lowering the liability is a lot of those 188 people who are eligible are longer service employees, many of them eligible for the Med 100 plan. So we've looked at the idea of saying that when you retire, you are not you will not be eligible to continue the same plan you were on, but you must go to the Med 1000 plan, or maybe the Med 500 plan. That would lower the per capita cost in terms of calculating cost from $12,000 to right around $5,000. That could have a big impact. We could see a lowering of the cost of maybe $1 million just on that item alone. So, before we do it, we're going to ask the actuary when they do the valuation this year to give us, to cost that change. And then when that changes, when we know what the real savings is, the impact of that cost, you know, a decision will be made on that change. So generally, what has happened is the pension committee, who supervises this plan too, is looking at, you know, the actuarial report, is looking at the plan, is looking at it every year, and has a good handle on what it costs and what changes can be made. So if someone comes to us and says, what are you doing about your GASB liability, we can show them, this is what we're doing. We looked at it when it first became effective. We made plan design changes, and we've continued to make plan design changes each time. We know what our costs are. We're funding some of those costs, and we're working to control and manage our cost for our post-retirement medical expenses. And you wouldn't have anyone say, you don't know what you're doing. They would say, fine, you have it under control. So we think that we're in good shape on this plan. Now, I'm going to pause. I'm going to move to the retirement plan unless there are questions. Yeah. Yes, sir.
There are a couple of questions. Your paragraph one talks about, it's kind of confusing because it talks about early retirees paying 100%. But then
that's early retirees who were hired after July 1.
Yes, yeah, understand. Yeah, understand. But then there's a caveat here about unless they retired with over age 55 with 28 years. Does that? How do you read that?
That's so they qualify for
the. Yeah, You have to first qualify for it. So you know, if you're an early retiree and you don't have the service, you're just not even eligible to pay for it yourself.
Yeah, but you had stated at in your beginning that this applied to people that were over when they once they attained the age of 65.
Well, after age 65, you still have to have, in order to qualify, you have to have 28 years of service, or at age 65, 20 years of service to get the benefit. So if you retire at 65 with only 15 years of service, you're not eligible for the Medicare supplement benefit.
So what happens to the person who's age 55 and has 28 years of service and retires? Does he pay 100% until he's 65?
Yes, he pays 100% until he's 65.
Okay.
And then at 65, he goes to the Medicare supplement.
Okay, and that's my second and last question on this area. The Medicare supplement, you said, costs $5,000.
No, that is a per capita cost. That it actually includes claims and includes a portion for your stop-loss insurance, too. So, but that is what the actuary has said is the per-head cost based on claims.
But that I've had a Medicare supplement before, and it had just filled in what Medicare didn't cover. Is our plan beyond that? Does it also include dental?
I have not looked at the plan specific.
Okay.
I'm not involved in that. But based on the cost, I believe it's a little richer than a basic Medicare supplement plan.
Because that's the reason I asked the question. I mean, it's only like $1,200 for Medicare itself.
Yeah.
And to have a plan that's $5,000 to supplement a $1,200 a year plan.
I can get
sense.
Information yeah. on the Medicare supplement plan. That's not something I have not been involved in negotiating any of the individual plans at all.
But your understanding is it covers not only the insurance, but the overhead to run the program. And
the city is self-insured on that. Okay, so that's what they're paying for per person.
Okay.
So I'm assuming it must have some drug coverage and some things of that sort.
All Thank you.
Okay.
Now, let me really ask a supplementary question. When age 65 is reached, regardless of service, 1 year or 50 years, whatever it happens to be, do they transfer over to Medicare and then this supplement takes, we pay the supplement part?
At age 65, first of all, they have to have had 28 years of service to be eligible for it. So let's say someone takes early retirement, okay, and they don't have 28 years of service. Well, they're not eligible for it, and because they retired before 65, when they turn 65, they are not eligible, okay? If you retire at 65 with at least 20 years of service, you automatically go on the Medicare supplement. If you retire early, you have to have the 20, after 55, you have to have the 28 years of service. And the deal is that when you take early retirement, you have to elect for the retiree coverage. Okay. If you don't, you cannot come back and elect it again. Okay?
Same way as that I would do. The other one, the trust fund, and we had a discussion of this, Mr. Pierce and I have had it also. The money that goes in the trust fund, that's just there. Can it ever be used, or it just builds up for eternity?
No, it can't. The idea right now is building up, and the reason for it is you get a break on the interest assumption used for discount purposes. GASB 45, and I'm going to discuss this in the retirement plan, GASB 45, unlike the GASB rules on retirement plans, has an interest assumption that you must use if you do not fund it, okay? And the interest assumption you must use if you do not fund it is the same interest that the city would get on its uninvested cash, in effect, and generally less than 4%. So for those entities that are not funding GASB, they're having to use a 4% discount rate. Now, if GASB says if you fund it, then you can use is a discount rate, whatever is earned in the trust. Now, you have to fund it 100% to use the full discount rate. If you fund it 50%, you can use 50% of that discount rate. So right now, we're trying to build the trust up to allow us to use a larger discount rate to have a lower liability. Now, if you wanted, you know, let's say the city had some issues that they did not wanted to use the money, you could use the money at any time. The plan is not to use the money until the trust builds up enough to generate the return, the discount that we would like to see, and then it can be used on that.
And this is true with the commercial companies like an IBM or DuPont or them. That's a heck of a chunk of money they have to put in to do what you just said, to bring this trust fund up. That's billions.
No, they have different rules than the GASB rules, okay?
Okay.
They have different rules than the GASB rules, okay?
All right, thank you.
Okay. Can we move to the retirement plan?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, before we start on the retirement plan, I'd like to correct an earlier comment that I made that may have been misunderstood. When I earlier spoke to you and stated that Aiken should be proud of its retirement plan, since longer service employees could retire with 80 to 90% replacement ratios, I did not mean to imply that the retirement plan itself provided this benefit. I was talking more from an HR standpoint rather than a finance standpoint, saying the way we approach employees is to say, if you work here your career, this is where you're going to be. That 80 to 90% includes Social Security benefits, for which the employee themselves pays a portion. The plan formula itself provides a retirement benefit of 34.4% of final average earnings, and final average earnings is only base pay if you have 20 years of service, and provides a benefit of 54.6% after 30 years of service. So that 80 to 90% is by no means what the plan is providing. That is the totality of retirement benefits when you add Social Security in with plan benefits. But the plan itself is providing anywhere from probably a high 30% to 55% of pay for your people between 20 and 30 years of service. Because I think that some people may have misunderstood that the plan itself was providing a replacement ratio of 80 to 90%.
Corner, I've heard you describe the retirement plan as more like a three-legged stool.
Yes.
The individual has their savings account, whatever form that takes, their Social Security, and then there's the pension payment.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And if you took the way we try to explain it to new hires is that if you work for the city your entire career, you'll be well taken care of in your retirement, and you will. We're not saying we're going to pay all of it. I mean, you have Social Security, you got your own savings, but you know, at the level you're providing, when you add those others together, you're going to hit that ratio. But you're not. The city itself is not paying for an 80 to 90% retirement benefit in the plan.
Could you explain the Social Security subsidy? That was one of the questions I came here tonight with, and Richard mentioned that because. First of all, it isn't paid by Social Security. It does.
It's not a subsidy. Okay. It's not a. It's just a form of benefit. Okay. The plan calculates. If you bear with me a moment, the plan provides under the formula a benefit based upon your years of service times a factor. 1.8% for the first 20 years of service times your final average pay, which is base salary averaged over 3 years. And that provides you, you multiply that together, it provides you a dollar benefit that the plan then provides is payable to you for life. So let's say, for example, that someone is entitled to $1,500 a month under the plan formula for life. The plan then says to that person, you can receive that money in various optional forms of payment, all of which are the actuarial equivalent to $1,500 a month for life. Now, to determine an actuarial equivalent, you have to know a life expectancy and you have to know an interest rate. So all we're doing is calculating different present values of money, you know, time value of money. You could say, I don't want it for life. I want it payable for my life and my spouse's life. So you look to the actuarial tables and say your life expectancy is 23 years, your joint and survivor life expectancy is X number of years. The tables have a factor that you multiply times that present value of a life-only annuity, and it says the $1,500 a month, if you want payable for you and 100% for your surviving spouse, is reduced to $1,300 a month. And you're going to get that for your life and the life of your surviving spouse.
Warner, if I may, that's on page 37 of your agenda material.
Yeah, it has the various forms. Now, the Social Security benefit is something. It's just a different. The Social Security supplement is just a calculation. What it basically provides is an early payment of a larger amount and a smaller payment and a payment of a smaller amount at a later time. Okay. And this is one calculation I cannot do with a calculator. You need a program. So the way the Social Security is says, okay, and it only applies if you're retiring before age 62, okay? You're taking early retirement. You're saying, you're taking early retirement. When you get to be 62, we're looking at your earnings, and we're going to estimate that you're going to get $1,000 a month, okay? You're entitled, let's just say, based on the formula at your early retirement, you're entitled to $1,500 a month for life. Well, if you, when you reach 62, you would get $1,500 plus another $1,000 for $2,500. And you say, no, I'm retiring 5 years early. I don't want to live on $1,500 for 5 years before I get to my $2,500. I'd like to have maybe $2,200 for my life. So what we do is we enter into the calculation what the estimated Social Security benefit would be. We say, what is the actuarial equivalent that we can pay you for the next 5 years, and then pay you for life thereafter, so that the level amount you get from us plus Social Security when it kicks in is the same. So we may say, okay, we can pay you $1,800 a month for the next 5 years. And then when Social Security kicks in, it's going to drop down to $800 a month. So you get $1,800 a month for the first 5 years. When you reach 62, you're going to get $1,000 from Social Security and $800 from the plan, so you still get the $1,800. But what you're getting from the plan is still the actuarial equivalent of what you of what your basic benefit is. We're not paying any more, we're not paying any less based on time value of money and the interest rate we use. You're just getting it sooner. It's like a mortgage. You know, if you take a 15-year mortgage, you're going to pay more a month. If you take a 30-year mortgage, you're going to pay less a month. And that's all it is an acceleration of the form of payments at the beginning, but reduced payments at the end, so that the totality of the payments you get is still the present value of your benefit. You're not getting any more money or any less money, assuming you live to exactly your life expectancy.
Okay, thank you.
Okay? Yes, sir.
Assuming you've hit 65 and you're getting part from the city and part from Social Security.
No, we do it at 62 for this purpose.
62,
we require you to do this. We require you at 62 to take early Social Security retirement.
Okay.
Now, we don't require you to take it, but at 62, your benefit's going to drop. Okay, we make the calculation as if you took early Social Security, the earliest you could at 62.
What happens if Social Security gets a cost of living? Does that affect the city's...
No, because we're assuming a fixed dollar amount. Your Social Security cost of livings are yours, because we just determined what the offset was, because it does not affect the present value of what you're getting from the plan.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay. I want to visit the issue of the actuarial assumption and funding. I know this is something dear to everyone's heart here and has raised a number of questions. But that's really what I'm going to talk about right now is actuarial assumptions and the funding of the plan. And I want to give some background information. You read a lot in the paper about comments of other people of interest rates and other things, but let's make sure that when what you're reading that really compares to the city situation, and I'm going to go through the city situation a little bit, but frequently what you're reading in the paper is rhetoric by others who are posturing themselves for another group, particularly when you look at California, the Midwest, New York, look at states that have public employee unions. Most states with public employee unions, the trust funds are jointly trusteed. You have union trustees, you have trustees appointed by the state. The setting of the actuarial assumptions and such are normally a trustee function. And so when you're getting ready for collective bargaining and you're going to start wanting to broadcast to the unions, don't come asking me for extra money. What do? You start making public statements of we need to change interest rates. We need to do these things. Anything else to broadcast the message that, you know, don't ask us. We're in bad trouble. Don't ask for the fund. And so a lot of what you see in these instances are people, you know, broadcasting their message of we're going to be tough on our negotiations and we're not going to increase our benefits. This doesn't apply to Aiken. I mean, you control your plan. And what your goal is to assure that your funding is level, to assure that current taxpayers are paying their fair share, that you're not shifting any burden to future taxpayers, and that current taxpayers are not overpaying by paying too much so that future taxpayers don't have to pay. And I'm going to show you how the committee has evaluated this and some of the standards we do. So, you know, we really want to use the funding. We want you to understand funding and how we look at it. We want you to understand the actuarial concepts and the accounting concepts. The actuary has basically said, with the assumptions that I use and my approach is to try to set your contribution as a percent of pay. The approach that we use is to try to keep your contribution level as a percent of your covered payroll. That with these assumptions, as your payroll goes up, your contribution is going to go up. As your payroll goes down, your contribution is going to go down. So the city's contribution has generally been between 10 and 12% of your covered payroll, and that's the range. And the actuary has said, as long as we're contributing there, and if assumptions work well, on a long-term basis, if you contribute that percent of payroll every year, you're paying your fair share for your current expenses and amortizing some past service liability. And that's what they're focused on. So let's look at why, let's compare what Aiken's done and let's compare what other public plans have done and why some of these other plans are in trouble and why I'll show you I don't think Aiken's in trouble at all. There have been two, every time I come to you, there are new studies out. There have been two real recent studies, one by the Pew Center, very well respected, in June of this year, the other by Boston College Center for Retirement Research in May of this year. And what they both are saying is that, you know, why are these public plans in trouble? And what the reason they're in trouble, there are generally four reasons. They took contribution holidays. You know, when earnings were high, money was tight, or they wanted to use it for something else, they just didn't contribute to the plan. Now, interesting enough, there is, for a plan of a government entity, there is no legal requirement, unless state law imposes one, but there's no retirement plan requirement that requires you to contribute to the plan. So states and other government entities could take a contribution holiday if they wanted. They could just say, we're doing well, the earnings are doing well, we're just not going to contribute. Also, they increased benefits. And they frequently increased benefits, assuming that market gains were going to pay for them, or not having some understanding of what the true cost of the increased plan benefits were. They also allowed overtime pay, bonuses, and extra compensation right before retirement to be counted towards the benefit. So there was what's called spiking. People's benefits were going up above what the actuaries assumed because of increased compensation right before retirement. And then two, when the market crashed and the investment losses occurred, it was kind of like accumulation of all the things they were assuming just went south, and it accelerated the losses. So what did Aiken do? Aiken during this time never took a contribution holiday. There was at one time, and I'll go over the exact funding, there was one time, from an accounting standpoint, the plan was 102% funded. The whole plan was 102% funded. Did Aiken take a contribution holiday that year? No. It still contributed 10% of pay. Aiken's never taken a contribution holiday, has continued what the actuary has said. I kind of compare Aiken to the turtle and not the hare. It's been slow and steady as it goes along. They've never increased plan benefits. The plan, the basic plan benefit of the plan has remained the same. We've not gone in and increased benefits. We've kept the plan benefit where it was. There's never been any spiking because the plan benefit is based on base salary. Last 3 years, average base salary. There's no opportunity for spiking. No increased benefits because of overtime in the Aiken plan. And then, too, I'll go over what's happened when the market crashed in 08. I'll go over what's happened. You'll see the investment losses were not nearly as bad for Aiken as they were for other plans, and Aiken has recovered. And if you would allow me, I'd like to read one sentence from the Pew study, which I think just shows what has happened. It says, keeping up with the annual required contribution is perhaps the most effective way that states can responsibly manage their long-term liabilities for public sector retirement benefits. That slow and steady, never take a contribution holiday. With the compounding of money, that hurts you the most, and you never did that. So let's look at your plan and what you've done on the funding. Generally, the retirement committee, every year they get the actuarial report. We get it once a year. It's done as of the end of the fiscal year, June 30. It's normally delivered in the fall or winter following the end of the fiscal year, and we review the actuarial report. Aiken's goal has been to be at least 80% funded. Pew Center, Boston College, National Association of State Retirement Plan Administrators, everyone says that for public plans, if you're at least 80% funded, you're in good shape. Aiken's goal has been to be move above that, but that's what they've looked at the minimum. Then, and I want to go over some numbers on funding for you, but before I do that, I need to talk to you about the difference between the actuarial numbers and the accounting numbers, because I'm going to give you both actuarial funding and accounting funding, and they move in opposite directions because they're two different purposes of these numbers. The actuary is looking at a long-term ongoing plan concept. He's saying what happens to the plan on a long-term basis, so I don't have, you know, like this, I want it to be more like a wave. The accounting profession is saying, no, what we look at is a date, a fixed date. At that date, we look at what it is. We don't care. So the accounting can go like this because you look at the fixed date. And so they're very different concepts used in valuing these issues. And they're both approaches have value, but you need to understand them both and you need to look at them both. Because funding versus financial reporting, and between the two you can get a blend and you use them both to get a comfort level of where you are with this. So I'm going to give you some numbers if you can bear with me on this. Let's go back to 2004, and I went to 2004 because you changed actuaries in 2004, and I have all the reports of the prior actuary in the format, and it's easy to find the numbers. But from an accounting standpoint, the two items that we have to look at are market value of assets and the interest rate. From the accounting standpoint, we have used since 2004 a 7% interest rate for valuing for your accounting purposes, okay? For your accounting purposes, your accounting number is a footnote in your financial statements. It's going to change, and I'll discuss that in a moment. Right now, it's a footnote in your financial statements. From an actuarial standpoint, the actuary uses 8% interest and views assets using what's called a smoothing method. The accountant looks on June 30 what the assets were there. That's it. The actuary says, I'm using a five-year running average of the assets, so I don't have spikes. I try to smooth it out. So the value of the assets used by the actuary for determining funding is smoothed over a five-year average. So when the assets are going up in value, the actuarial valuation using the assets is, the accountant's up here on that fair market value, the actuary's right here. When the assets are going down in value, the accountant's right here, the actuary's right here. So the numbers are never going to be quite the same. So in 2004, from an accounting standpoint, you were 96% funded. The whole plan, 96% funded, the present value of your accrued benefits. From an accounting standpoint, you were 83% funded. Assets went up a little more the next year. Actuarially, 87% funded. Accounting standpoint, 99% funded. In 2006, assets went up some more. Actuarial, still 87%. Accounting, 96% funded. 2007, actuarial, 93%. Accounting, 102% funded. And we were really happy. Assets were going up, and that was for the 2007 plan year. Now we're going to look at what happened in 2008 and 2009, okay? And then what's happened after that. The market, at the high point of this 2007, you had about $18.9 million. At the low point during this reduction in the stock market, which in March, you had $13.9 million in assets. With the market meltdown, you lost about 25% of the value of the assets. Now, what happened was, it happened over different times. The actuary values everything as of June 30, so both the 2008 and 2009 valuations reflected this, okay? So, in 2008, we only had a small loss. Most of the losses had not occurred then. We had a actuarially 90% funded, accounting 92% funded. So we'd gone down a little bit. But 2009 is when the big hit came because of the fall of the fiscal year. And from an accounting standpoint, you went from 92% funded to 69% funded. However, because of the smoothing on the actuarial side, you went from a 90% funded only to an 85% funded. And that was the low side. In 2009, we had a positive return. Assets started going back up. And you went back up to 2010, assets started going back up. From an actuarial standpoint, you went back up to 80% funded. From an accounting standpoint, you went up to 71% funded. In 2011, had even higher return, and you were back from an accounting standpoint of 81% funded. However, from the actuarial standpoint, in 2011, we dropped off the fifth, sixth year became dropped off, which was a good return, and so your funding from an actuarial standpoint went down to 74% funded. As of, and give you some idea of assets, your assets today, as of May, were a little over $21 million. So you were at that 18, you went down to 13.9, you're back up to 21 million. You've basically recovered from the loss that you had. Now, we've not recovered from the missed earnings assumptions. Take us another couple of years. But from an accounting standpoint, at that 21, you're back above 80% funding. Mm-hmm. From an actuarial standpoint, you're going to stay, you're probably going to be under 80% because of the smoothing, because we're dropped, because we haven't gotten rid of all those bad years that are bringing us down. And the point that I want to make is that when we had the good years, the committee said, we're going to keep contributing at the same percentage pay. We're not going to take a vacation holiday, and we're not going to change our interest rate. We're going to keep it where it is. So we keep this slow, steady pace. So you did it in the good years. We got through the bad year, and we're continuing on. And I think that it's working. And you're saying, okay, well, what have our real returns been? And I'll give you some idea. Since 2004, if you take the annual average, you take the annual return each year, add them all up, and divide by those 8 years, you come out with 7.99%. If you take the value of what $1 was at the beginning of the time and track that through your earnings each year, so you're showing the compounding effect, you've had 102% return since that time, and you have a little over, divided by 8, you have a little over 12% return. There. So the actuary says 8% seems to be a reasonable amount. Now, you've never hit exactly 8%. During those 8 years, you had 16.5% return, 12% return, 6% return, 15.5% return, a minus 3% return, a minus 18% return, a positive 10% return, and a positive 25% return. We had never come anywhere close to 8%. You know, but we're looking at an average and a long-term approach. So what I would suggest that we do, and then if you want to start seeing it, we get these numbers every year. They don't ever appear in the financial statements, but if you want to see them, we can show you that on a chart every year. So you can say, where are we funding on an actuarial standpoint? Where are we funding on an accounting standpoint? And be comfortable that the approach we're using is fair to our current taxpayers. That's what you want to be. You want to say, we're not overpaying, we're not underpaying. Mm-hmm. That we're following an approach that we can tell our current taxpayers, you're paying your fair share for this year. You're not paying too little, so we're going to shift it to someone else, and you're not paying too much, because you could run the risk of paying too much, but you're paying your fair share. Now, I would like to talk to you a little bit about what changes you'll see in your actuarial statement very briefly. But before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions, comments about the issues, because I know those are items dear to your hearts.
Only that I would accept your offer to give us those reports and would love to see them.
Yes, yeah. We would.
Okay. Those are significant. You mentioned it before the meeting, and that just puts, I think, puts me at ease, quite frankly.
I think Kim may have some information that'll be helpful to council.
Yeah, we have those. We get those every year. I didn't realize you did.
It's in our comprehensive annual financial report.
Really? What page? Right.
Now what she's showing you here is that the actuarial? Okay. Those are the actuarial reports. We can also separately show you the account. Those are the accounting. No, that's a percentage contributed. We can also show you the accounting reports, the actuarial reports, which to me, you know, when assets are going up, if you're doing, you want to grab the accounting report. When assets are going down, you want to grab the actuarial report. But you look, compare the two of them.
What page is that, Kim?
58.
58. You're in the CAFR.
In last year's January.
But we can also include the accounting. We're going to have to start giving you more accounting information.
That's a GASB requirement, Mr. Dwyer, so it's a good point, and that additional information can be included in there.
How far back will you go? What clawback years?
How far back are you going?
About a 10-year. I think 15? That's a 10-year average, isn't it?
From
96. Yeah, it goes that.
Yeah.
The other part,
15, yeah.
While you were discussing that, and I've read that report and I compared it to the audit, and the two numbers are very difficult to bring together. They use actuary in here and funded ratios. And once in a while, all the numbers you were reading, I could find them in here. And I'm just wondering, how do we get the three reports to say the same thing?
You don't, because they're two different professions under two different standards showing two different items, okay? And they don't say the same thing. That's part of what you need to do is you're getting a report from your actuary saying, if doomsday occurred tomorrow, this is what it would be. And your actuary is saying, we're going to continue for 30 years, and this is what it's looking like right now. And it is impossible to reconcile them because they have different standards that they use and different rules.
Okay.
And you need to understand the two, and between the two of them, you kind of get comfortable of where you're going with the plan.
Which report would you use to start seeing trouble cropping up?
Trouble cropping up is you see contribution holidays, people don't contributing. If your funding is down in the 60% range, I mean, give you an idea. The state of South Carolina, Pew report showed every state. State of South Carolina, on their own statements, is only 66% funded. You know, that's a problem. Also, you know, and we're talking about $44 billion total liability. You know, you're not anywhere close to, you know, you're not, we're in millions and under 100 million there, well under 100 million. So when you get under 60%, funded, and you took contribution holidays, you have a real problem because that money's not in the plan and you got to double down on your contributions, which makes it very difficult in this environment for public units to do on that.
Which numbers do I use, the annual audit report from finance or from the audit to feel good about? Because one of them, you know, the lady in when she reviewed last year's audit to us, you know, we were looking at $16, $18 million with the current plan, and we all fell off our chairs, you know, on the OPEB benefits.
No. OPEB's different.
Right.
OPEB's right. That's about right on the OPEB. That this is retirement plan.
The retirement, okay. I would use which number?
This is what I would use, okay? You're going to get, if you're willing to listen, I'll explain the actuarial if you
I'm
want.
I'm the only one interested, but don't waste
okay,
the other
okay,
time.
Okay.
But I just want to know which report makes me feel good.
Okay. Let's do it this way. The actuarial report will give you the present value of accrued, will give you two numbers. Present value of accrued benefits to date. Okay? That would mean if you ended the plan today, this is the dollar amount that would be required to pay all the benefits as they come due. Okay? And that number, bear with me one. I have the last year's report.
We got to assume we're going to keep going.
That number is around 20-some-odd million dollars, okay? No, it's because you're about $4 million underfunded on that basis. Yeah, okay. That number is...
That's okay.
Okay. You got the present value of accrued benefits today from the actuary. The actuary also gives you the present value of future benefits, saying service, I'm going to assume continued service, and I'm going to assume continued cost of living increases, and that's the number you're going to have at some future time, but you got to make future contributions. So I would ignore that number. That's a hot number, okay? Because you're assuming future service.
All right.
So you take that present value of your current benefits and then compare that to the two asset values. Compare that to the fair market value and compare that to the smoothing value, okay? To give you some idea of how much you're really underfunded. And you're about four right now, as I recall from last year, it was somewhere around $4 million, okay, of that. You know, but watch that when you see both the funding numbers together, the accounting and the actuarial, as long as you're moving in the right trend, you're okay. Remember, one number I hadn't thought to tell you is that all the studies show that a typical government plan, 60% of the monies used to pay benefits comes from earnings. Contributions are only 40% of the monies for benefits. So the earnings on your long term are the important items. So don't feel, and what the committee did, if you remember, what the committee did when this 08 happened, they increased the contribution. They were doing 11%. They moved it up just 1% to like 12% of pay. So they increased the contribution slightly to help work this down. But we're saying we're going to rely on what's happened on a long-term basis and work towards getting out of that issue. And it has worked.
Okay. Thank you.
Got it. Yeah.
Any other questions?
You're making progress. I understand a lot more than I did before you started.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Professor.
I want to thank you so much. Appreciate it.
There's not been tested.
There's no test.
That's a good thing.
Okay. Warner does a tremendous job for us. He's far too humble about his capabilities, but he has been just stalwart and rendered excellent advice on the federal regs that are affecting this plan.
Absolutely. Very good. Under old business, first item, appointments to boards, commissions, and committees. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, we have four pending appointments to fill vacancies on the various boards, commissions, and committees tonight. Councilmember Diggs recommended Dr. Jack Benjamin, who's a professor of visual and performing arts at USC Aiken, to our Arts Commission. If appointed, his term would expire April 11, 2014. And Councilmember Price has recommended the reappointment of Andrew Balknight to the Building Code Board of Appeals. That term would expire May 12, 2014. And for consideration tonight is approval of these two appointments to this board and commission as recommended.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and second?
I move approval of both nominations.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Second, okay. Any discussion? If not, show hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. And before I forget it, are there other nominations?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to nominate John Horvat for the Housing Authority.
Mr. Mayor, I'd also like to recommend the appointment of Butch Robertson to the General Aviation Commission.
Okay. All right. Any others? Okay. They will appear then on our agenda, next meeting agenda.
Yes, sir. We'll have it on for the 9th of July.
Okay. Second item, second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to rezone property at 1103 Richland Avenue East from light industrial to general business. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance to rezone certain property consisting of 1.24 acres of land owned by Benjamin Tillman Timmerman III and others, and to rezone that from light industrial to general business. The Planning Commission did review this at their May 15 meeting. They approved the request with the conditions that proof of recording of a restrictive covenant be recorded in the Aiken County RMC office, the deed office, or register of deeds, limiting the intensity of development for the 1.24 acres so that the net new vehicle trips to be generated will be fewer than 3,000 trips per day, that an agreement with the city listing all conditions in the agreement, as I say, be recorded in the register of deeds or RMC office, and these conditions be met within 180 days. Council approved this at first reading on June 11th, and for consideration tonight is second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to rezone this property from light industrial to general business.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and second?
So move.
I second.
Okay, any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Item 3, second reading public hearing of an ordinance to annex property at 2805 Catawba Street into the city limits and to zone it single-family residential, RS 15. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance to annex to the corporate limits of the city of Aiken certain property owned by Timothy Boyce and located at 2805 Catawba Street, and to zone the same residential single-family RS 15. As we discussed at the first reading, this property is contiguous on two sides to properties already within the city limits. Planning Commission reviewed this voluntary annexation position and unanimously recommended that it be annexed. You approved this at your June 11th meeting, so for consideration tonight is second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to annex this property into the city limits.
Okay, thank you. Do we have a motion and second?
Move to approve this, Mr. Mayor, on second reading.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
All right. Any discussion? If not, show hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Under new business, first reading of an ordinance to assign the Bus Ave Dell Inc. hangar lease to Victory Aviation Services, Inc. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of an ordinance is an ordinance approving the reassignment of a lease between Biz Avdale, Inc. and Victory Aviation Services, Inc. Dale Phelan had an airplane and hangar at the municipal airport, and with his tragic death, the company has been selling his assets and de-accessing other items as well. As part of the sale of the aviation equipment, Victory Aviation Services has requested that the lease be assigned to them. This was an original lease that was between Sport Plane, Inc. and VW Airplane. That's now Aiken Aviation. Through various assignments, it wound up being with Biz Avdale. There is a balance of time left on that. In our conversation with the representatives from Phelan Corporation, it's our understanding that this particular business, Victory Aviation Services, would potentially be interested in locating additional planes at our airport. So for consideration tonight is the first reading of the ordinance to allow the assignment of this hangar lease, which is required by our lease with the FBO at the airport.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and second?
I move to approve the first reading of an ordinance to transfer the lease.
Okay. I second.
And second. Any discussion?
Just one quick question. Now, this is talking about the land, or is this land and building?
This is the actual hangar that's on
a hangar
the
and
lease
it's on city
land.
Property.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay, this is not the industrial park buildings. This is the actual hangars where
this is the hangar that the airplane goes into.
Thank you.
Can we get the revenue from that?
I'm trying to remember that there's some of the hangars that are actually on the FBO's land. So we go to the FBO, and then the FBO pays us. And then there's some separate city hangars, and we just get that money in. If it's my understanding, and Larry, you'll have to help me remember, I believe this is on the FBO lease space, as I recall. Right. Okay, that's right. That's right. Yeah, there were two plans. That's right. That's right.
Okay. All right. Okay. We've got a motion and a second. Just show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay. Passes unanimously. Under petitions and requests, the summer meeting schedule for July and August 2012. Mr. Pierce.
Thank you, Mayor. We just wanted to confirm the practice of council in the past is to have one regular meeting in July and one regular meeting in August. We've typically done that on the second Monday in both months, and we would just ask for council's consideration and vote for the meeting schedule for the summer months.
Okay. Do we have a motion and a second?
Mr. Mayor, I move we'll cancel a second meeting in July and August.
Okay. Any discussion? Hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously.
If any matter arises that we need to schedule a special meeting, we certainly can do that. And that being said, I have had a conversation with the FBO, and the council wanted to meet out at the municipal airport, and the FBO has time available Thursday, July 26th, or Friday, July 27th, and I didn't know what council's preference would be for that special meeting at the airport.
Well, let me clarify. I'm the one that's been asking for it, and I don't care whether it's at the airport or here at the council. It doesn't make any difference to me. And my interest is so that we understand the structure of the airport, the structure of the contract. You know, for example, even tonight we're changing a lease, and some of that land on the city airport is not our land, I guess.
Well, it's all city land.
Yeah, it's all city land, so we must lease it somehow to the
We do. We have a long-term lease with the FBO for the portion of the airport.
I mean, we did this when I first came on council with the Housing Authority. You know, they came in, they briefed us, they gave us a good briefing, and I was able to understand what they did. So that's what I'm looking for. To me, it doesn't make any difference, Richard, whether it's out there or whether it's in here. But I don't know if the rest of the council has any feelings one way or another.
Well, why don't we just invite them to come to the council meeting, put it on their agenda.
Okay, Mayor.
That's the easiest thing. We're all here anyway, and why not have a couple of them?
We've just canceled the second meeting in July, though.
Right. Well, and again, we actually had it set up that way, and council had indicated you would rather have a standalone meeting because it could be an hour or 2 hours long. We can set it up any way council wants to.
Okay.
The FBO is ready to do
meeting.
That.
Well, if it's going to be that long.
Yeah. I mean, if we did it here, we'd probably need to do a work session before. I mean, I don't think there's any planned action we have beyond.
There's nothing to vote on.
What is the purpose of the meeting with the FBO?
Just to get a sense of what the airport's all about.
Right. My understanding was that council wanted to have a better understanding of the FBO's role at the municipal airport, the setup of why we have an FBO, that the city doesn't run the facility, and then just an opportunity to see the facility. And, of course, we've completed the runway lights installation, the ILS system, and there will be a chance for council to see all that and kind of get chapter and verse on it as well.
And I would hope think meeting at the airport would be better.
Well, that's fine. I
hope before we meet we'll have a chance to look at how other local airports are operating, how much they charge for fuel and rent.
And you had actually sent us a memo requesting that information, yeah. Mr. DeWard. Our intent would be to provide that in advance of the meeting so
that's
everyone
good.
Would have that information.
Yeah, that's fine. I have no brothers one way or another where it's at. And you want it July 27th?
I would do it on Friday.
July 26th?
Is there anything else we need to talk about here on the information?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. All right. Next item then is information issues.
Wanted to get a date for that meeting.
We're not going to have a second meeting. Then why would it be? It's just like a second meeting if we're going to meet on July 26th.
Well, you're not going to vote on items. This would be to go to the airport for a tour and get the information from the FBO. And the FBO will be here and available on Thursday, the 26th. Posted Monday day.
Wait a minute.
My preference would be the 26th.
This month?
Or July 26th. July 26th.
Yeah. So what time are you talking about, Richard?
we could do whatever council would care to do.
Mayor, do you have a preference?
We talking a morning meeting, afternoon meeting, evening meeting? I mean, does it
whatever council would care
to matter to the folks there that will be
FBO's available that day.
Okay. Well, what's your desire? Are the vacations that are going to this going to interfere with my vacation?
Yeah, my schedule is fine, but we got some workers in the in council that
well, that's right.
Businessmen.
I would prefer if we're going to do a visit during the week, I would prefer either the early morning hours or the late afternoon. Not in the middle of the day.
Still when it's light, so that you can see.
Definitely.
See around.
Definitely.
You're not kind of trying to get me up too early, are you?
Yeah, I don't like that early thing either.
Well,
I'm not talking about 6 o'clock.
What time would suit you and Leslie?
6 o'clock is fine.
No, the only question I have is now, we have, before we consider that, you had mentioned we need a work session prior to that. When would that be?
No, I'm just saying, it doesn't make a difference how we do it, Steve, whether it's a work session or a meeting out there.
Okay.
It would be a presentation of items that would work out there.
Yeah. 1 to 2, okay.
Yeah.
Should we say 4 o'clock that day?
4 o'clock?
Is that okay?
That's fine.
Done?
4?
Okay. 4 o'clock?
26. July when?
July 26 is a Thursday.
14.
And we'll send notice out so you have that.
Okay.
Another thing I wanted to make council aware is that the ASPCA is planning on opening their facility the 1st of August, and council is invited to a tour. That would be Thursday, July 19 at 5 p.m., and your spouses are invited as well. And I've had an inquiry from the chair of the Planning Commission, and we need to schedule our joint meeting council and the Planning Commission, and a date that was mentioned was July 16.
Has it always been a July?
It has not always been a July.
I thought it was more like September, maybe. Or
It actually is a little earlier than July, but with the planning director's situation, we just scheduled it for later, and July 16 is a Monday.
What is that for now?
That's the annual joint meeting that you have with the Planning Commission for action items for them to work on in this next year.
What time is that?
Typically, we've had it at 5 p.m.
Does it make it too long a day for the council to do it on the night? I mean, start at 5 and then take a break? Because usually that before it hasn't taken 2 hours. It's been shorter.
Mm.
And I guess, you know, Ms. Diggs would be part of that. You give them twice versus once, or you sit down for one long time.
And again, we're happy to do whatever council would care to. When we've tried to set that up in the past, I think there were some conflicts and we wound up not doing that. So.
Can you think of any bit? Are we going to have a busy agenda?
It's a fairly full agenda. I about filled up my book.
On the 9th?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
16th at 5 p.m.
What, Reggie?
Since the 16th at 5 p.m.
Planning Commission joint meeting.
And then I have the memo to distribute to council. We promised you at the last meeting that, and I think, Mr. Edward, you've already got your copy, that we would do some follow-up investigation on the ridge at Chucker Creek. And we have this information. We will be following up with the developer. We have it on the agenda for July 9. So Reggie already has his copy. So I wanted to put that in your hand. And then the other thing at your desk was this book by David Kennedy. I've had an opportunity to speak with most of council about the trip that Chief Baranko and I took up to High Point, North Carolina last week. And this High Point has used David Kennedy's model for addressing violent crime in the community. Now, they've committed 15 years to their efforts and involved the community very actively, and they have reduced their crime rate by 52%. So we'll be talking about this material later in the summer and meeting with some focus groups, because it will take community participation for this effort to succeed. and the officials, including the community volunteers, are willing to come down this fall to Aiken and give a presentation of what the High Point model looks like and what's worked very well for them. And that's what I have, man.
Okay. Well, Gary's going to give us a little update and also for the press concerning a recent court case that appears to affect a lot of different municipalities. Gary?
Thank you, Mayor. As I've mentioned to council in the past week or so, the South Carolina Court of Appeals recently came out with an opinion in the case of Dennis Lambrees versus the Saluda County Council. In that case, Mr. Lambrees filed suit in the Saluda County Court alleging that the County Council had violated the Freedom of Information Act because they engaged in the practice of amending their agenda during a public county council meeting. The municipal attorneys around the state have been somewhat divided on this issue. On one side, you had the municipal attorneys who believed that as long as city council was meeting publicly, the city council had the ability to amend their agenda if they so desired. And that's been the position that Aiken has used since I've been city attorney over 15 years. The other line of questioning was, how did the public know what you were talking about if your agenda was fluid? And that was the more conservative approach to making sure that the councils complied with the Freedom of Information Act. And it was, I don't have the numbers, but it was a fairly even split as to who felt you could do it this way and who felt you could do it this way. Well, the Court of Appeals answered the question for us last week when they came out with this opinion, and they erred on the side of ensuring that the public was fully aware of everything that council is doing, and they decided that if council posts an agenda, and the law requires you to post an agenda, that once you go into chambers to have that public meeting, that you can't add anything else to the agenda to have another discussion about something that the public did not have knowledge of. And they somewhat concluded this opinion. One of the things they say is the provisions of the chapter talking about the Freedom of Information Act must be construed so as to make it possible for citizens or their representatives to learn and report fully the activities of their public officials at a minimum cost or delay to the person seeking access to public documents or meetings. And when they answer the question where they say you have to or you cannot allow amendments to the agenda during a public meeting, they admit this is a close question because no provision in the Freedom of Information Act appears to prohibit such action. However, to allow an amendment of the agenda regarding substantive public matters undercuts the purpose of the notice requirement in Section 30-4-80. A narrow construction of Freedom of Information Act may support the position that so long as regularly scheduled meetings are open to the public, they are conducted in compliance with the FOIA, which is what we had been doing. However, such a construction would be in consonant with the agenda notice requirement for regularly scheduled meetings and would go against the instruction that the Freedom of Information Act is to be liberally construed. So they say they make it clear that public bodies should not modify their agendas. Those agendas should be published for the public to see, as we always do. And I believe this will require council to make a small change to how business is conducted, such that if someone, I'm assuming council doesn't want to change your long-standing practice of not allowing the public to speak.
No.
Or allowing the public to speak. The hiccup that this new case requires is if somebody wants to come to a city council meeting to speak, they need to let the city manager know that they want to do that. They need to give him the purpose for why they want to speak, so it can be placed on the agenda so that the public has adequate notice of what's going to be discussed during a city council meeting.
I have a real heartburn with that. I got to say, I'm not a lawyer, but it's been a bad month for the South Carolina courts. I mean, we started out with the legislative-appointed Supreme Court and their nonsense disenfranchising so many thousands of voters in the state, and the candidates want to run for office, and now my heartburn with this thing is that, you know, we're an elected body, and I think any citizen ought to be able to come into this chamber when we're in meeting and tell us, talk to us about anything. Now, that said, we haven't had a lot of people coming in that wanted to do that. And there seems to be kind of a conflict with the conservative and the liberal wording, as you read it, Gary, because you're talking about liberally supporting the Freedom of Information Act, but we're going to be so liberal that we're really going to tell the members of the public that we can't talk to you until you come and tell us what it is that you want to say. And in fairness to the staff, they need to know that by Tuesday at the latest, I would think. Now, if it's somebody that just wants to, no, they've got to tell us what they want to talk about. So I'm sure staff may want that in writing. I mean, it just flies in the face of what, I mean, I grew up in a town where you had a public meeting and people could come and talk, and I've never seen a council that wouldn't accept an input from a member of the public. I mean, somebody has a complaint about the city, and we're going to say, I'm sorry, but you got to sit that complaint for 5 days until you tell the city that you want to appear in a council?
The focus is, from looking at the Court of Appeals opinion, the focus is not on what the individual citizen wants to say. It is focused on does the entire public, if they look at the agenda, have knowledge of what's going to be discussed at a public meeting? That's how they rationalize that opinion.
If we had on our agenda, as we have in the past, or if we put on our agenda something that had to do with public comment.
Public comment about what?
Public comment.
I think that's what they're...
Well, you can get this to the point that we need to have everything in writing before we have a meeting.
Right.
I mean, that's too conservative an opinion as far as I'm concerned.
Dick, we had public comment last meeting, and we've had it a lot of times, and that points out the exact thing why I don't think it's right. We had a wonderful lady stand up and talk about something and talk about an owner's property and what wasn't being done, and the owner was not here. He did not know about it. And that is not right when we're going to hear things, remarks about something or somebody or some situation that both parties are not here. Okay, now, so there's nobody on this council that wants to hear the public more than me. I've been saying it for 20-some years in here. I've taken pride in saying we have never turned a person out that wanted to stand up when they came through those doors and speak. And I know others feel the same way. But the law is the law. And if this is the law, then we need to move forward. We need to live with it. And I personally think it's a good idea, because we don't want things to happen, in my view, just like it happened last Monday night, the last meeting. Now, that's a small item, perhaps, but it points out the exact problem that we have.
Let me respond. That lady that came in here has been complaining to this council for 8 years about her problem. Now, let's say that we're going to comply with this new law.
That's fine, but the owner...
You're upset because the owner wasn't here.
And who has said the owner's not doing things out there? He's doing a lot out there. But he should have been here. That's my point.
Okay,
I'm not taking up for the owner. I'm saying if she was going to be here to talk like that, he should have been here.
Okay, so what you're saying now, if she comes and calls the city manager on Monday and say, I want to come to appear on the council...
Right.
So what does he do now? Does he have to say, no, wait, I got to find out if whoever you're going to complain about can come or not?
How would you like somebody coming in and talking about you and you're not here?
We weren't complaining about him, Mr. Mayor. I wasn't complaining about him.
No, but she was.
She was complaining about the fact that the council approved a plan, and for 8 years she's been looking at a project and which violates what she thought was going to happen.
Yeah, okay.
But, I mean, let me go back to the point, because we talked about that last meeting. Now, if she comes and wants to get on the agenda, she has to be on the agenda. Now, is there a condition of that? Does she have to have the right? I mean, this isn't criminal to confront her, confront confrontation or anything. But how are we going to handle that? If she comes and wants to be on the council the next meeting, how are we going to handle it?
I think when somebody comes to Richard and asks to be on the council, on the agenda, he has to understand, well, what does this involve?
Okay,
what do you want to talk about, and does it involve other people that also need to be here to hear what you have to say? Now, that's the way I see it.
Well, I mean, is that comport with what your understanding of the law is?
Your city manager controls your agenda.
Yes. Well, no, it's the Court of Appeals that control our agenda.
Well, okay. But your city manager controls what goes on to your agenda.
Okay.
And Richard would have to speak to this, but certainly you can envision something like what the mayor's talking about, where a person may want to be on the agenda to talk about a specific item, and the city manager wanting to make sure that council gets a balanced opinion about things may want to have somebody else speak on the same subject, somebody that's maybe involved with the decision. If it's, you know, somebody complaining about the development of a gas station on Richland Avenue, you may have to have the developer there to talk about it. If it's just somebody wanting to talk about, somebody wants to bring up a new subject to council, hey, I thought you guys might be interested in doing something about this, maybe Richard decides that's the only person that needs to speak.
Well, Gary, I got a
question. Certainly council has the ability, and we may very well consider modifying your rules of procedure to include specific provisions about, putting the public on the agenda if they want to be on the agenda, in light of this change to the agenda.
Well, I think we need to tell the citizens how the process is going to work. I mean, we owe them.
What are the mechanics? I mean, the agenda basically gets published on Thursday prior to.
Let's use the lady as an example. I don't know if she contacted a council member in advance and said, "Hey, I would like to come speak," or if somebody asked her.
She did talk to Richard.
That council member simply directs her to Richard and says, here's Richard's phone number or his email address."
Yeah, but no. I'm a little bit more concerned about what is the city's responsibility in the person of Richard to annex or publicize a new agenda. I mean, Amy sends out a newspaper article on Monday. Does he have to turn around and keep Amy?
Richard posts the agenda on, is it Friday afternoon or Friday morning or Thursday morning?
Thursday. Typically it's Thursday.
So it's basically on Thursday.
Yeah.
But what if somebody comes in and, on Friday?
In essence, your agenda is locked on Thursday.
How do we get notified there's an agenda change?
Once we send the agenda out, that'll be the agenda
that'll
for the
be
meeting.
So basically, like we did, when we were talking about small businesses and so forth last summer and what have you, I mean, there were a lot of people that kind of migrated from the topic, so to speak. Is it the mayor's option to say you're out of order, thank you,
sure,
and surrender the mic?
Sure.
Is that
you're off focus. You're talking about something that the agenda did not envision. If you want to bring up that subject, we can add that to as an agenda item at a later meeting.
Yeah, and we see that at the state legislature, it has to be germane to what you're considering. Any of the debate or discussion that has to relate to.
Then let's go back to the mechanics now. Let's say Dick wants to put something on the agenda for the next meeting on the 9th, I believe, or Reggie. He has to come to you prior to you publishing on a Thursday prior to our meetings.
Right.
Do you have to identify if you bring along somebody, a spokesperson or a representative, or who tells that representative that he's going to be, or are you prompted by the representative to create an agenda item?
Well, here's the way I would see it as your city manager.
You're going to get the developer here, even if Reggie had come to you 2 days prior.
No,
because 2 days prior isn't going to work. It's really best to have the information by the Monday before the meeting because of everything that we put together. And poor Miss Sarah, the worst thing in the world is a Tuesday or Wednesday. We were running around with last-minute changes when she's trying to get it published and on the system. So it's best the Monday before. So if there's something for the July 9th meeting, like, John Q. Public wants to come in and talk about trash pickup, then I need to know that by Monday. We put it on the agenda,
and Gary will say, you know, citizens have a constitutional right to petition government for redress of their grievances. It's just we need to give notice to the public that John Q. Pope is going to come in and talk about trash pickup, because they might want to come in and add their two cents, or they want to hear it. If they just come and start talking about it, nobody knows about it except the folks in this room.
Well, is there an allowance for an emergency situation? Something may crop up between Thursday and Monday where I think it's imperative
if it's a true emergency as defined by state law.
Yeah.
Yes. True emergency.
Yeah.
Who makes the judgment on it?
Tornado, hurricane, ice storm. I mean, you could always meet an emergency session. That's under your emergency plan.
Yeah,
we have that. You have that ability right now.
Would you hold that at the same time we have a scheduled meeting?
If it's an emergency,
it coincides with the timing.
If it's an emergency matter, the mayor has a right to declare a state of emergency, and then council meets within 24 hours. So there is a procedure in place for that. Yes.
Is it possible? I know this happened with the state Supreme Court with their ruling that people went back and asked for clarification. Can we ask this Court of Appeals, is this what they intended, to make it more difficult for the public to address this body?
I mean, you'd have to be a party to the suit. I mean, some of the parties to the suit would ask for that.
We're impacted by the suit. Make us a party?
In their opinion, I think they candidly admit it's a close call, but they're falling in line in favor with making sure the public is fully aware.
I don't think it's going to be a problem once we get to starting.
On a path forward, can somebody, either Mr. Pierce or Mr. Smith, give Amy the right information as we know it today so the paper doesn't misprint it, assuming she's going to print this? Can somebody give her a proper statement?
She's not typing.
Heard everything that Gary had said.
Well, I've been speaking for 15 minutes, and I'd rather her have the right answer than... because Mr. Ebner did this.
If we want something in the record tonight, as your city manager, based on council's concerns and what I'm hearing from the city attorney, is if a citizen wants to come and address council at the council meeting, the Monday before the meeting, that's Monday at 5 p.m. before the meeting the following Monday, if they could just either email or drop by a written request to be added to the agenda, my name is... my contact information is, and I want to speak on, we're good. Then it will be on the agenda.
Well,
they'll be petitioning city council.
That's not what we just got through talking about if Mrs. Miller comes in, because then you said you'd want to have, if somebody comes in and has a complaint, you want to make sure whoever or whatever they're complaining about, if it's something to do with the city.
No, sir. Let me clarify something.
Good.
What I said was the request was to change a concept plan. That concept plan was adopted by ordinance. To change an ordinance requires an ordinance. Before an ordinance can be voted on, you have to give public notice of that ordinance. That was the problem with the request. The request is changed, I understand, at this point. So, as I said, when Mr. and Ms. Miller were in the room, it's on the agenda for July 9. We're going to notify the developer. The developer may have an understanding of what that letter of credit does. Our staff sure has an understanding of what the letter of credit is. And again, my sense is I'd rather have the affected parties in the room so that council doesn't hear just one side. But if a citizen wants to come in and state a grievance, we have to all understand that that's one perspective on a particular concern or issue, and there may be other relevant information before council would take any action. And you know, one reason we have the joint meeting with North Augusta on the 18th is so everybody could be in the same room at the same time to hear the same message. And I'm just finding, as your city manager, that's really what works best. You know, if it's divided up and we don't have advance notice of it or something, it just creates a lot of confusion and a lot of emotion unnecessarily if we're all in the room and we can just discuss it. It's a very simple, easy approach. And, you know, I think what you've seen as your city manager is I tell you everything. I give you all the documents. I give you everything because I want you to have the same information I have so you can make an informed decision. And you can keep asking me about this. I want to make sure you have the information you need to make an informed decision. That's what I see my role as your city manager. Because y'all set the policy, and then I'm the fellow that tries to get it all done.
Well, the frustration is we've never been empowered to take action of an item that's not been on the agenda. So even people coming in and talking to us, it's a listening only. It doesn't make any difference what they say or what about. Well, we've never been empowered to do anything because it hasn't on the agenda if under the old rules where it was a public comment. So.
Well, but there again, too, the only thing I'm trying to do as your city manager is that we all know they're coming, or a council member knows they're coming. I just want the same treatment that I give you. I want everybody to know they're coming. And then the folks that have an interest in it can come in here and hear it. And you know, there may be additional information that affects that item. So it's just part of the transparency of that's what's going on in this room at that time. Nothing more.
Well, okay.
Beat that horse.
We are adjourned.
She's here for the straight skinny.
Good. Yeah. Excellent.
All right.
Excellent.
Pretty good timing, quarters on that.
Yeah. Even with our extended discussions.
Yeah, that's right.